given any hint that she suspected Keith might be having an affair. On the other hand, she answers him quietly, "Do you think it's possible?" "I don't know. I don't think they ever met, other than the party a year ago. He certainly never mentioned her to me. I never thought he was the type to have an affair." "They could have met online," Olivia says. "They could have met anywhere." Paul looks back at her, radiating tension. "Olivia, Amanda Pierce was killed in our cabin. I didn't kill her, but who do we know has been to our cabin?" "And that's why she's unsure. Glenda and Keith come to their cabin every summer for at least a weekend or two. They know the cabin very well. Their fingerprints are everywhere and perfectly explainable. Keith could have met Amanda there that weekend and nobody would have known, because Keith probably would have known that they wouldn't be using the cabin that weekend." "But how would he get in?" Olivia asks. "Keith knows where we hide the spare key," Paul says.
"He does?"
Paul nods, biting his lip. "I told him once how we drove all the way to the cabin that time and forgot the key, and how after that we hid a spare in the shed under the oil can." They look at each other, an uneasy dread spreading across their faces. Could it have been Keith, Olivia considers, and not Amanda's husband, or Larry, or Paul at all? "What should we do?" Olivia asks. "We have to tell the police," Paul says. "Let them look into it. They can seize his computer." Can she do that to Glenda? Keith probably wasn't even seeing Amanda, but he was seeing someone. Olivia looks at her own husband, who must surely still be a suspect, and knows that they must. "If you go to the police," she says, "you'll have to tell them how you know. You'll have to tell them that Raleigh broke into their house, too, and looked in his computer." "I won't. I won't tell them how I know."
"That's so naive, Paul. If they seize Keith's computer and find he was seeing Amanda, Keith will be a suspect in a murder investigation. Everything will come out."
"We'll just have to cross that bridge when we come to it," Paul says bluntly. As she settles under the covers and tries to sleep, she can't stop thinking that if Keith did kill Amanda, then he was willing to let his best friend take the fall and say nothing at all. She feels a deep chill, and she doesn't know if that chill will ever go away. She pulls the covers more tightly around her and lies in the dark, eyes wide open. It's late. Carmen is reading in bed when she hears the knock at the door. How odd. She hears it again. There's definitely someone there. She gets up and slips on her terry robe, wrapping the tie around her waist as she descends the stairs. When she gets to the bottom, she flicks on the light switch. She peers out the window and then hesitantly opens the door a crack. "Hi," she says, smiling uncertainly.
"Sorry to bother you so late, but your lights were still on."
"No problem. What can I do for you?"
"Can we talk?"
"Okay," she says. She steps back and opens the door wide. Then she turns her back to her guest, closing the door. Everything changes in a fraction of a second. There's a sudden movement behind her, and then she feels something around her neck pulling tightly. It happens too fast for her to scream. She can't breathe, and the pain in her throat is excruciating. She can feel her eyes bulging, her vision blurring, as she tries desperately to grab at the cord around her neck. But her knees are buckling, and now she's being pushed forward, her own weight working against her as she leans into the cord around her neck. She realizes with surprise that she's dying. No one thinks this is how they're going to die. And then everything goes black.
Chapter 35.
Glenda is surprised to find Olivia on her doorstep the next morning.
"What is it?" Glenda asks quickly. "What's happened?"
Olivia always calls first. She doesn't just show up unannounced like this. She'd texted her yesterday when Paul was released and told her not to come over. Her husband has been released without charge. Why does she seem so distraught?
"Are you alone?" Olivia asks nervously.
"Yes, they've gone already. Come in," Glenda says.
"There's something I have to talk to you about," Olivia says, not meeting her eye.
Glenda starts to feel apprehensive.
"Okay."
They sit down in the kitchen.
"Do you want coffee?" Glenda asks.
"No."
"Olivia, what is it? You're freaking me out."
"The detectives matched Raleigh's fingerprints to some found in the Pierce's house," Olivia says.
He's been charged with breaking and entering.
Oh, no, Glenda says. But that's not why I'm here, Olivia says.
Raleigh told us some things yesterday.
She hesitates and then comes out with it.
He told us that he broke into your house the night you and Keith were over for dinner.
Glenda is shocked. Her mood changes abruptly. Why would he do that? She asks.
I'm so, so sorry, Glenda.
Everything about Olivia is begging for forgiveness. She looks abject. But Glenda feels betrayed, violated. She had no idea that Raleigh might have broken into their house. That's different. All the smooth, glib assurances fall away. Now what she's thinking is, how dare he? She doesn't say, oh, that's okay, Olivia. I know how upsetting this must be for you. Please don't worry about it. She doesn't try to make it better. She doesn't say anything. She folds her arms in front of her chest, not even aware of how defensive she looks.
I don't know why he did it, Olivia says. Just teenage stupidity, I guess. You said it yourself. Teenagers do stupid things.
They're sitting at the kitchen table, across from one another. It feels awkward, although they've sat here together 100 times. Okay. Thanks for telling me, Glenda says finally. I guess there's no real harm done, is there? She says it rather grudgingly, and she's pretty sure Olivia knows how she really feels. But there's something in Olivia's face, and Glenda knows that there's more coming. What is Olivia afraid to tell her? Because she looks frightened to death. There's something else, isn't there? Glenda says. Olivia nods. Her face is pale, her lips are quivering, and she looks so sorry that Glenda almost forgives her in advance. Whatever it is, it can't be that bad, Glenda thinks.
You know, Raleigh was snooping around on people's computers, Olivia begins.
Glenda's sure there's nothing on their computers they need to worry about. She and Keith share the same home computer. What is Olivia getting at?
He found some emails on your computer.
What emails? Glenda asks sharply.
Emails that show that Keith's been having an affair.
Glenda feels like she's been kicked in the stomach. For a moment, she can hardly breathe. No, she says. Raleigh's lying. There are no such emails. Why would he say such a thing?
I don't think he's lying, Olivia says carefully.
You know he's a liar. Glenda snaps back. He told you he was at the movies when he was out breaking into houses. Why do you even believe him?
Why would he lie about it?
Olivia says. He's not saying it to get himself out of trouble. Why would he make it up? I don't know, Glenda says at a loss. But I use that computer all the time, and I even admit I do look through Keith's emails sometimes, and it's all work stuff. There's nothing there to any other woman. If there were, I'd know. Olivia looks even more uncomfortable and says,
Raleigh says they were hidden. You have to know what to look for, and Raleigh knows.
Suddenly, Glenda knows it must be true. Hidden files? How could she have been so stupid, so blind? She shakes her head. She can't even speak. She wants to kill him.
I'm so sorry, Glenda, but I thought you should know.
Finally, Glenda finds her voice. Who is it? Is it anyone we know? Now Olivia shakes her head.
I don't know. Raleigh says it was a made-up name.
That son of a bitch, Glenda says.
Do you think,
Olivia says, venturing cautiously as if over thin ice,
that he might have been seeing Amanda?
Glenda turns cold eyes on Olivia. Amanda, why would you ask that?
I don't know,
Olivia says quickly. He probably barely knew her. Then why mention her? Olivia shakes her head, backtracking.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have.
Maybe you should leave, Olivia, Glenda says.
Don't hate me, Glenda, please,
Olivia begs.
I didn't want to tell you, but I thought if it was me, I'd want to know.
Glenda replies acidly, or maybe you thought you could shift the attention away from Paul. Is that it? One more possible suspect? Are you going to tell the police about this? She looks at Olivia's face.
My God, you are going to tell the police.
Olivia sits in front of her, biting her lips. Get out, Glenda says. Olivia scrambles to her feet. Glenda doesn't even get out of her chair as Olivia turns to leave. Glenda hears the front door close, and then the house is silent. She feels terribly alone. For a long time, she doesn't move. Then she springs from her chair and climbs the stairs to the spare bedroom they use as an office. She sits down at the desk and turns on the computer. She tries everything she can think of, which isn't much. She can't find the hidden emails, but she believes that they're there. And though she wishes she didn't, she believes Raleigh is telling the truth. Finally, fighting back tears of frustration, she gives up and collapses onto the spare bed against the wall. And then she reaches for her phone to call her husband.
Webb hears someone tapping at his office door. An officer pops his head in. Paul Sharp here to see you, sir.
Surprised, Webb says, "Show him into an interview room. I'll be right in." He sees Moen on the way. She's coming toward him down the hall.
"Paul Sharp just came in. Let's go."
She changes direction and falls in beside him. As they enter the interview room, Webb hopes this might be a breakthrough in the case. He can sense the same anticipation in Moen.
"Mr. Sharp," he says, having reminded him of his rights and turned on the tape, "is there something new you want to tell us?"
"Yes."
Webb looks at him inquiringly and waits. He doesn't look like a man about to confess to murder, and he hasn't brought his lawyer with him.
"I might be completely wrong about this," Sharp begins, "but I thought I should let you know. I've learned that a friend of mine was cheating on his wife, and I think he may have been seeing Amanda Pierce."
"And why are you just telling us this now?"
"I just found out."
"How did you find out?"
Sharp looks uncomfortable. "I'd rather not say."
Webb looks back at him, mildly annoyed, and exhales heavily. "Why are you wasting my valuable time, Mr. Sharp?"
He doesn't answer, merely looks stubborn.
"What makes you think this man was seeing Amanda Pierce?"
Sharp says nervously, "He knows our cabin. He's been there."
"Who?"
"Keith Newell." The name is familiar.
"Right. His fingerprints were in your cabin. We eliminated him."
Sharp nods. "He and his wife visit us there every year."
"And you now think he was seeing Amanda, but won't tell us why you think so?"
"I don't know that he was seeing Amanda, but he was seeing someone. He was having an affair. I don't know who with. And he knows where we keep the hidden key. I told him when he was out of the cabin last summer."
Webb chews the inside of his cheek.
"I see." "Look on his home computer," Sharp says. "Look for the emails to his girlfriend. Maybe you can figure out if it was her."
"And how do you know about these emails? Did he tell you about them?"
"No." Paul Sharp looks away. "But I know they're there."
"Keith," Glenda says tersely into the phone, "I think you'd better come home."
"What? Why? I'm just heading into a meeting."
"Olivia was here this morning. She says Raleigh broke into our house. He got into our computer."
"What? What the hell are you talking about? Why would Raleigh do that?"
She hears the fear in his usually calm voice. She ignores his question. "What are you hiding on our computer? Emails to another woman? To Amanda Pierce?"
Her voice climbs. The stunned silence on the other end of the line tells her everything she needs to know. She could kill him.
"I'll be right home,"
Keith says, sounding panicky. Chapter 36.
Detective Webb knocks on the door firmly. He's obtained a warrant to search Keith Newell's computer. The two men with him and Moen are tech experts. They'll get his computer and other electronics. A woman answers the door. "Mrs. Newell?" Webb asks, holding up his badge. He notes the woman's pallor. She's clearly been crying.
"Yes," she says.
"Is your husband at home?"
They'd already called his office, expecting to find him there, wanting to question him, but were told he'd been called home suddenly.
Webb notes her reluctance to answer.
Finally, she says, "Yes, he is."
"We'd like to talk to him," Webb tells her. She seems to know what this is about. She opens the door without saying anything further. Webb steps into a front hallway, and she leads them into the living room.
"I'll get him," she says.
Webb wonders if Keith Newell is at the computer, hurriedly deleting files. It doesn't matter. They can recover just about anything. A few moments later, Keith Newell comes down the stairs looking nervous. Webb says,
I'm Detective Webb, and this is Detective Moen. We'd like you to come down to the police station to answer a few questions.
About what?
Who are they? Keith says, indicating the two silent techs. They're the technicians who are here to get your computers, laptops, tablets, smartphones, and so on.
You can't do that.
Actually, I can. I have a warrant. Webb holds it up, sees the fear in the man's eyes. Keith Newell looks from him to his wife, obviously feeling cornered. They leave the techs behind in the house with Newell's wife and drive him to the police station. There, they lead him into an interview room and advise him of his rights. He says he doesn't need a lawyer. He says he's done nothing wrong.
So, Webb begins, did you know Amanda Pierce?
Newell looks warily at them.
Yes, I knew her.
Were you having an affair with her? Newell looks as if he's poised on the edge of a precipice. The panic in his face tells Webb the truth, no matter what he might say next. But Newell says,
yes, I was having an affair with her, but I didn't kill her.
Tell us about it.
We didn't want anyone to know. Her husband was very jealous. He made her life miserable at times. She wanted to leave him.
Did you ever see her at the Sharps cabin?
He nods, exhales deeply. Just once, the weekend that she disappeared.
He stops as if he can't go on. His hands are shaking.
What happened, Mr. Newell?
Moen asks quietly.
I knew the cabin would be empty that weekend. I knew the family wouldn't be going up. I knew where they kept the spare key. Amanda and I wanted to see each other, and I didn't want to go anywhere we might be recognized. Then I thought of the cabin.
He clears his throat, takes a sip of water, his hand trembling badly.
She told me that she could go away for the weekend, that she would tell her husband that she was going away with her friend Caroline, shopping. So she packed an overnight bag, and I gave her directions to the cabin. She knew I couldn't stay all weekend. I told her that. I told her I could come out late Friday afternoon for a while, but that I'd have to go home, and that I'd come back for most of the day on Saturday. But I couldn't just leave my family for an entire weekend. It would look too suspicious. She was fine with that. She was happy to spend time with me, but she also liked her alone time. She liked to have time to be away from her husband. So I went up there on Friday afternoon around 5. She arrived about a half hour later. I stayed for a while, but I couldn't stay too late. I left around 8. Everything was fine when I left her. I went home. The next day I told my wife I was going golfing, and I went back to the cabin. The first thing I noticed was that Amanda's car wasn't there. I thought that was odd, because I'd brought up everything we'd need. I thought maybe she'd just gone for a drive. I was a bit annoyed, because it's a long drive up there and back, and I couldn't stay late. The door to the cabin wasn't locked. I went inside, and everything was all tidy. None of her things were there. She'd gone. I found the key on the counter. You couldn't tell she'd ever been there. There was no note or anything. I checked my phone. There was no message, no text, but she'd already warned me that her husband had found her burner phone. I wondered if she'd changed her mind about the weekend, or maybe about me, or maybe something had come up at home. Anyway, I waited around for a long time until it was time to go, hoping she'd come back, I guess. But she didn't. And then I locked up the cabin and put the key back under the oil can and just went home. I didn't know what else to do. I couldn't tell anyone. On the way home, I drove past her house to see if her car was there, but it wasn't. The next day, I drove by her place again, and her car still wasn't there, but the garage door was closed, and I thought it might be inside. I had no way to reach her. My texts and emails would go to her burner phone, but her husband had it. I didn't know what to do. I was a mess, but I had to pretend that everything was fine. Then I heard a couple of days later that she'd been reported missing by her husband. He looks up at Webb, his face haggard. He's the one who killed her, I'm sure of it. Back then, the rumor going around was that she'd left him because she'd told her husband she was going away with a friend, and he found out it wasn't true. But I know she lied to him to be with me. I think now that he knew, and he killed her. But at the time, I thought, I hoped, that she really had just left him. After she was found, he hides his head in his hands.
After she was found, you didn't come forward with any of this, Webb says, not bothering to hide his contempt.
Newell shakes his head, looking remorseful. I know. I'm not proud of it.
He takes a shuddering breath.
Her husband must have killed her. She told me sometimes that she thought he was a psychopath. He wasn't the man she thought she'd married. He was manipulative. He played games. She wanted to leave him.
He runs a hand through his hair nervously. She'd send me texts telling me what their marriage was like. It was abnormal.
What are we going to find on your computer? Webb asks after a bit.
Emails to Amanda?
You hid them.
Of course I did. I used a burner phone mostly for Amanda, but sometimes I sent emails to her burner from my laptop. I didn't want my wife to see them. If it weren't for Raleigh, nobody ever would have known any of this.
Raleigh Sharp? Webb asks.
Keith snorts. He broke into our house and found those emails and told his parents, who obviously told you, the little shit.
I see, Webb says. And what happened to your burner phone?
I smashed it to pieces and threw them in a passing garbage truck.
After a moment's pause, Webb asks, Did you know about the other men she was seeing?
Amanda? She wasn't seeing any other men, just me.
Webb can't believe the man's gullibility, or perhaps it's his ego.
Seriously? You didn't know? She was meeting someone else at the Paradise Hotel quite regularly. We have video evidence of it.
Newell's face drops and he looks away.
No,
he asks.
Who?
Larry Harris.
Webb feels a certain satisfaction at the look on Newell's face. How do we know that you weren't the jealous one? Webb asks.
You were at the cabin with her that Friday. You went back again on Saturday. She hasn't been seen since that Friday. As far as we know, you were the last one to see her alive. You knew she'd told her husband she was with Caroline, that it would look like she'd simply left. Did you know she was pregnant? Did that not fit with your plans? Did you argue about it?
Newell looks back at him in growing fear.
No. I mean, yes, I knew she was pregnant, but we didn't argue about it. She was going to terminate it.
I'm not sure I believe you, Webb says.
I want a lawyer, Newell says, his voice frightened. Webb gets up to leave the interview room and signals to Moen to join him. He sends an officer in to facilitate Keith Newell's call to his lawyer. They'll let him sweat and shake while he waits for his lawyer to arrive.
Glenda paces restlessly around her house. The two techs left long ago, taking all of their computers and electronics with them. She's terrified. Keith told her he'd deleted the emails, but she's afraid that isn't good enough. She's pretty sure that the police know how to recover deleted files. That's what they do. Keith has been gone for hours. She doesn't know what's happening, and it's driving her mad. They obviously suspect him of murdering Amanda. He was seeing her. He admitted it to her and will probably admit it to them. They'll find the emails. They'll charge him and try him for murder.
What will she tell their son?
She thinks regretfully of Olivia. She has never needed a friend more than she does at this moment, but Olivia's the last person she wants to talk to right now. When Adam gets home from school, Glenda is waiting for him. He drops his heavy backpack to the floor just inside the front door with a familiar thud and sweeps past her on his way directly to the kitchen for something to eat. He doesn't even seem to register that she's standing there.
Adam, she says. She follows him into the kitchen. We need to talk.
He opens the fridge door and then looks over his shoulder at her warily. She swallows.
Your father is down at the police station.
He goes still as a stone. He's being questioned about Amanda Pierce. A look of dread comes over her son's face. There's a drawn-out silence.
They're questioning everybody, though, right?
Adam says.
Yes.
They'll let him go, Adam says. Like Raleigh's dad, they let him go.
I don't know, she says, her voice tight. I don't know what's going on at the station, but the police took your father's computer away.
Adam stands completely still for a moment longer, his face pale. Then he turns away from her abruptly and leaves to go upstairs.
Wait, Adam, I need to talk to you!
But he's taking the stairs two at a time.
Raleigh is a wreck. He's the one who saw Keith Newell's emails. Because of him, his dad went to the police. Because of him, Keith Newell is sitting in the police station, probably suspected of murder. Raleigh just got a frantic text from Adam. Raleigh finally got his cell phone back from his parents after he told them the truth about the break-ins and swore he was done with hacking. But now he almost wishes they hadn't given it back to him. He stares at the text again. Well, what did he expect? He knew that as soon as he told the truth about Adam's dad, his parents might go to the police. He didn't feel like he had a choice, with his own dad still under suspicion of murder. Raleigh knows that Keith Newell is an asshole, but could he actually be a murderer? It's less outrageous than the possibility of his own father being a murderer. He looks again at Adam's text, then tosses the phone aside. He won't be able to contain it. It will all come out now, that he broke into the Newell's house and their computer, too. If Adam's dad goes on trial, Raleigh will have to testify about those emails. Everyone will know. Raleigh could be in big trouble. But if Keith Newell killed Amanda Pierce, at least his own father will be free.
Webb enters the interview room again late that afternoon, Moen behind him. Keith Newell now has his lawyer beside him. They resume the interview. Newell stubbornly shakes his head back and forth.
I didn't kill her. When I left her there Friday evening, she was fine. When I came back on Saturday at around 10:30 in the morning, she was already gone. Everything was cleaned up. I thought she'd changed her mind. I had no idea what had happened to her.
He stifles a sob, the exhaustion and the strain getting to him.
I knew something was wrong as soon as I saw her car was gone. I tried to open the door, but it was locked.
He stops suddenly. Webb feels Moen snapping to attention beside him. It was locked, Webb repeats into the silence.
No, Newell says quickly, shaking his head. I'm sorry, I'm tired. It wasn't locked. I walked right in and saw that the place was empty.
You said it was locked. I got the... You were going to say you got the key. Is that right? Webb says.
It was definitely not locked, Newell repeats. I went right in and the key was on the counter.
He looks at his lawyer, seems to signal something to him with his eyes. No more questions, the lawyer says. My client is tired. That's it for now. The lawyer stands up.
Are you going to detain him?
Yes, Webb says. We certainly are. Olivia arrives at Glenda's door. It's late, after 10 o'clock. The street is dark and it's cold out. She pulls her coat closer. She's tried calling, but Glenda isn't picking up the phone. Olivia knows she's home. Raleigh told her that Adam has been texting him because he's worried about his mom and asking him to send his mother over to help. So she's not exactly imposing. She's been invited over. But she's nervous because she's pretty sure Glenda won't want to see her. Glenda doesn't answer the door. Olivia rings the bell again. Finally, she hears the sound of footsteps. The door opens, but it's not Glenda there, it's Adam. He looks distraught, and maybe not completely sober. She can smell liquor on his 16-year-old breath. It makes her heart sink. She steps inside, into darkness. Where's your mother? He nods with his head toward the living room. She steps farther into the house, not stopping to take off her jacket. She sees Glenda sitting in the darkened living room. Olivia automatically reaches for the light switch. The light floods the room and Glenda blinks as if she's become unused to light. She might have been sitting there for hours.
Glenda, are you all right?
Olivia asks anxiously. She's never seen Glenda look like this. Her face is haggard. Usually she's pretty resilient, even in times of crisis. She's the one who holds the family together. Olivia glances at Adam, who is staring at his mother. He seems to be swaying slightly on his feet. Olivia feels the weight of it all pressing on her chest. How has everything come to this? She steps forward until she's closer.
Glenda, she says. I'm here.
Her voice breaks. Glenda is her closest friend. How can this be happening to her, to her family, to all of them?
I'm so sorry.
Glenda finally looks up at her and says, It's not your fault. Adam stands watching, swaying. Why don't you go back upstairs, Adam? His mother says. Adam flees, obviously relieved.
It's going to be okay, Olivia says, and sits down on the sofa next to her. She doesn't believe it, but she doesn't know what else to say. She remembers Glenda sitting beside her in the police station that day when their positions were reversed. She wants to comfort her. They've been questioning everybody, you know that. They'll talk to Keith and then they'll let him go, just like Larry, like Paul. He didn't kill Amanda, you know that. But she's thinking, it's someone we know. And truthfully, she thinks it might be Keith. For a moment, Glenda doesn't answer. Then she says, he's been there a long time. They kept Paul for a long time, and then they let him go. Glenda whispers, I'm so worried about Adam. Olivia nods. She's almost afraid to ask, but she must. She must know. Did you find out who Keith was seeing? That's it, isn't it? Glenda says. We all want to know if Keith was seeing her. Olivia waits for the answer. When Glenda falls silent, Olivia says, her voice a whisper, was he? Glenda lowers her voice to a whisper, too. Keith told me before the police came. He admitted he was seeing her. He said he deleted everything from the computer, but they'll be able to recover it, won't they? And then the police will know. They must know already. He must have admitted it. It's been hours. Olivia feels the blood pounding in her ears, terrified of what she might hear next. Glenda leans toward Olivia and says, Keith says he didn't kill her, but I don't know if I believe him. Olivia looks back at her, remembering her own doubts about her own husband, her heart breaking for Glenda.
Chapter 37. Webb paces his office while Moen sits tiredly in the chair opposite his desk and watches him. It's late, but they've got two people being held in the cells. Robert Pierce, who's been detained since the day before and who must soon be charged or released, and Keith Newell. Newell slipped up when he said the door to the cabin was locked, Webb says. Before, he said the door was unlocked and the key was left on the counter. Webb stops pacing and looks at Moen. That's what he wants us to believe. Why would he lie about that? Maybe he was just confused, like he says, Moen says. But Webb knows they both believe that Keith Newell slipped up. It was obvious. Why else the backpedaling and the sudden, silent plea to his lawyer to stop the proceedings? You don't believe that either, Webb says with a snort. No, I don't, Moen admits. I think he made a mistake in there a little while ago, and he knows it. He says he arrived before she did on that Friday, Webb says, so he probably retrieved the key from under the oil can in the shed before she got there. She probably didn't know about the hiding place. He never said she did. Moen is nodding. And he left the key with her because she was staying. And then he came back, and if it was locked, and he had to get the key, he would get it from the usual hiding place. Webb looks down at his notes. He said, I tried to open the door, but it was locked. I got the... And then he stopped. Webb continues. If the key was hidden somewhere else, he wouldn't have known where to find it. He's protecting someone, Moen says. Whoever killed Amanda Pierce must have known that the spare key was kept under the can in the shed and put it back there. Keith came back the next day, found the door locked, and automatically went to the shed for the key. But afterward, he must have realized that the only other people who knew about that hiding place were the Sharps. Robert Pierce didn't know about the hiding place. Unless Pierce saw Newell pick up the key, Webb considers. If Pierce was there, hiding, watching, he might have seen him go into the shed, but he certainly wouldn't have been able to see him get the key from under the oil can. It's way inside the shed against the wall. He might figure out the key was kept in the shed, but not where. Newell is trying to protect Paul Sharp. Webb nods. What if Sharp somehow knew that they would be using the cabin that weekend? What if he came up to the cabin after Newell left, knowing that Amanda would be there? He kills her, cleans everything up, dumps her body and car in the lake, and gets home in the middle of the night. Webb exhales loudly. Newell goes up the next day, finds the place deserted and locked, the key under the can. Moen says, Sharp must have been rattled, not thinking clearly. He forgets Newell will come back the next day and find the key in the usual hiding place, a dead giveaway that he'd been there. Webb nods again. Then Newell would be rattled himself. He wouldn't have known what happened, but he must have realized that Sharp had at least been there. When we questioned him, he knew that if he said the door was unlocked and the key was left on the counter, it meant anybody might have killed her, from her husband to a complete stranger.
Right.
Pierce wouldn't have known where to put the key, Webb says. We're going to have to release him.
I wonder how long Keith Newell has known, Moen muses, that his best friend is a murderer.
Friday morning, they head in to interview Keith Newell again. I want one more shot at him. Then we'll talk to Paul Sharp again, Webb tells Moen. Keith Newell has spent the night in a cell and looks it. Let's get started, Webb says, flashing a glance at Newell's attorney. Then he looks at Newell. I'm inclined to believe you, he says. The other man looks at him mistrustfully. I don't think you killed Amanda Pierce after all. Newell glances at his lawyer. But I think you're covering up for the person who did.
What?
No, I'm not covering up for anybody. I don't know who killed her. He's agitated, but trying not to show it.
I think you do.
Newell shakes his head vigorously, looks at his lawyer for support, then turns back to Webb.
I don't know anything about it. I told you, I never thought any harm had come to her until you found her.
And what did you think then, Newell? Webb leans in close and fixes him with his eyes.
I don't know.
You must have had an uncomfortable time since her body was found. You knew someone had killed her. Who did you think it was?
Newell doesn't respond, but his eyes look haunted. When you got to the cabin that Saturday, the door was locked.
No, it wasn't. It was unlocked and the key was on the kitchen counter, Newell says stubbornly. But he won't look at him. He's staring at the table.
Do you have a point to make? The attorney asks. Because we've been over this and he's told you quite clearly that the door was unlocked.
Webb gives the attorney a hard look. He also slipped up and told us that it was locked and that he had to get the key, and we think he got the key from the usual hiding place. Amanda Pierce was brutally murdered in that cabin, and whoever cleaned up put the key back in the usual hiding place.
Who else knew about that hiding place, Newell?
He sees that the man's face has gone ashen.
I don't know.
You don't know.
Well, let's see. Paul Sharp is the one who told you about it, so he certainly knew, didn't he?
Keith Newell looks at his lawyer and turns back to Webb. Who else? Webb demands. Olivia recoils when she goes to answer the door and finds Detectives Webb and Moen standing on her doorstep looking grim. What can they want now? When is this going to end? Do they want them to help put the final nail in Keith Newell's coffin? She wants to be done with this. She wants it all to be over.
Good morning, Webb says, all business. Is your husband at home?
Yes,
she says, automatically opening the door. She turns her head when she hears Paul coming up behind her.
What do you want? Paul says, guardedly.
We have a few more questions, Webb says.
I've already answered all your questions.
Paul protests, but he looks worried. Olivia can tell. He doesn't want to talk to them about Keith either.
We'd like you to come down to the station, Webb says.
What for? Can't you ask me here?
No, we want to interview you again on tape.
What if I refuse?
Then I'm afraid we'd have to arrest you, Webb says without batting an eye.
Olivia is suddenly frightened. Why are they back for her husband? What has changed?
Raleigh appears on the stairs. What's going on?
Olivia looks at her son in dismay, unable to find the words to tell him.
We'd like you to come too, Mrs. Sharp, Webb says. We have some questions for you as well.
They've left Paul Sharp in an interview room waiting for his attorney. In the meantime, Webb has also asked Glenda Newell to come in for an interview. They will talk to the two wives while they're waiting for Paul Sharp's attorney. They start with Mrs. Sharp. She sits nervously in the interview room. Webb gets directly to the point.
Mrs. Sharp, this won't take long, he says. I understand you kept a spare key for your cabin hidden in the shed underneath an oil can.
Yes, she says.
Who knew about the hidden key?
She clears her throat.
Well, we did, of course, my husband and I.
Anybody else?
My son knew.
He waits. She says quietly,
and Keith Newell knew about it. My husband told him last summer that we started putting it there after we drove all the way to the cabin once and forgot the key.
Anyone else?
She shakes her head miserably. No, I don't think so.
You see, here's the problem, Webb says.
He waits until she's looking in his eyes.
We don't think Keith Newell killed her, but whoever did cleaned up the scene and then returned the key to that hiding place.
She stares at him in horror as the penny drops. Chapter 38. Glenda watches the detectives, unsure of how to behave, what to do. The interview room is bare except for a table and chairs. It's intimidating. This is where her husband has been spending so much time. All those hours when she couldn't imagine what was happening at the station, she's beginning to be able to imagine it now. He's still here, somewhere, in a different interview room, probably just like this one. What has he told the detectives? What do they think? Are they going to tell her? Or are they just going to ask endless questions and try to get her to implicate him?
Mrs. Newell, Webb begins.
She looks back at him with dislike. She's angry at him. She's angry and afraid. She will ask for a lawyer if she thinks it becomes necessary. For now, she thinks she can handle this.
Did you know that your husband was having an affair with Amanda Pierce?
No.
He's admitted it, the detective says bluntly.
She looks back at him and says, I didn't know.
You're familiar with the Sharps' cabin, aren't you?
Webb asks.
Yes. The Sharps are good friends of ours. She pauses. We were out there in June of this year and again in July. Do you know where the spare key is kept? The detective asks.
She goes completely still. Pardon?
Webb looks at her more intently, and it makes her nervous. Do you know where the spare key for the cabin was kept? He repeats.
Spare key?
I don't know about any spare key, she says.
Webb fixes his eyes on her.
Your husband told us that you knew where the spare key was kept.
She can feel the perspiration start beneath her arms. It's hot in here, too many bodies close together. She shifts in her seat.
He's mistaken. I'm not sure why he'd tell you that.
It's an important point, Webb says. She doesn't say anything. She suddenly feels lightheaded. It is an important point. She knows that. They obviously know it, too. What has Keith told them? She realizes now, too late, that she should have told Keith the truth. But she didn't, and now they are in separate rooms being interviewed by the detectives. They should have got their story straight. They could have protected each other. But that's the thing. She never told Keith the truth because she couldn't be sure he would protect her.
Webb says, Your husband claims that when he left the cabin at around 8 o'clock that night, Amanda was alive. But when he arrived the next morning, around 10:30, her car was gone and the cabin door was locked. He admits he retrieved the key from the usual hiding place, under the oil can in the shed.
He leans in close to her.
Whoever killed Amanda Friday night cleaned everything up and returned the key to the hiding place. An easy mistake to make, Webb says, in the stress of the moment.
Glenda can't think of anything to say. It was such a stupid mistake.
Mrs. Newell,
the detective prods, but she ignores him, her thoughts falling over one another, remembering flashes from that awful night, scrubbing the kitchen floor, wiping down the walls, using the cleanser she'd brought from home, driving Amanda's car down to the bend in the road in the dark and deliberately sinking it, checking everything over, making sure it was spotless and tidy. She was so exhausted by then that she'd locked up and, without thinking, put the key back in its usual hiding place. It wasn't until Keith came home the next afternoon, looking so distressed, that she realized her mistake. Realized that he would look for the key and know that someone who knew where the key was kept had been there. Her best hope then was that the car with the grisly body in the trunk would never be found. That everyone, especially Keith, would think that Amanda had simply taken off. Keith would assume that either Paul, or more likely Glenda, had been there and had confronted Amanda, and that she'd decided to disappear and leave them all behind for good. He'd never said a word to her about it. Perhaps he was too afraid of what might have really happened. Beneath the confident exterior, he always was a coward. But then they'd found the car, the body, and they've been living with this between them ever since. Her knowledge, his fear. If only they had never found the car, Glenda thinks hollowly. If only Becky hadn't seen Paul in the car with Amanda that night, they wouldn't have had any reason to look at Paul, to search the cabin, to find the blood. There should have been no way for this to lead back to the cabin, to Paul, or Keith, or her.
Mrs. Newell? Webb says again.
Yes? She must focus. What is he saying? She can't admit to anything. It must still be possible to turn this around. She'd tried so hard all this time to protect the ones she loves. Adam needs her. He doesn't need his father the way he needs her. Maybe she can still pin this on Keith somehow. It would serve him right, the cheating bastard. She thought of everything except the key.
I don't know about any spare key, she says firmly. I don't know why my husband would tell you that, she repeats.
Sir?
Yes, what is it? Webb asks briskly. He's got his hands full at the moment.
There's been a report of a homicide.
Webb looks up in surprise.
Where?
On Finch Street, number 32. Neighbor found her, called 911. Victim is, he refers to his notes, a woman named Carmen Torres. Uniforms are on the scene, sir.
We'd better get over there. Send Moen to me, would you?
Yes, sir. Webb grabs his jacket and meets Moen on his way out.
What have we got? Moen asks.
We'll know when we get there, Webb says. They park on the street in front of an attractive gray house with blue shutters and a red door. There's yellow police tape across the front step, and a uniformed officer from patrol division standing guard.
The crime team is on its way, sir, the officer tells him.
Webb notices a woman standing off to the side on the driveway being comforted by another officer. She's probably the one who found the body. Webb steps into the house. The victim is sprawled on the floor. The woman is wearing a pink terry cloth robe and a nightie underneath. It's clear from the obvious bruising around her neck that she's been strangled with some kind of rope or cord, not something thin enough to cut the skin.
Do we have what she was strangled with?
No, sir.
Any sign of forced entry?
No, sir.
We've checked the house and grounds. Looks like she let her killer in the front door, and he did it as soon as she had her back turned.
She's in her pajamas, Webb observes. She probably knew her killer. He bends in closer. She looks like she's been dead a while, at least a day, maybe more.
The medical examiner is on his way.
Webb nods.
Who found her? The woman outside?
The officer nods.
A neighbor?
He catches Moen's eye, and the two of them head back outside. They approach the woman standing on the driveway. She's not crying, but she looks like she's in shock.
I'm Detective Webb, he says. Can I have your name, please?
Zoe Putillo, the woman says.
You found the body?
She nods.
She lived alone. I hadn't seen her for a couple of days. I noticed that she hadn't picked up her newspapers, so I knocked on the door. She didn't answer. I tried the door, and it wasn't locked, so I went in, and I saw her there.
She shudders.
I can't believe it. She was new to the neighborhood, trying to make friends.
Did you know her very well? Webb asks.
Not really, just to speak to, Zoe says, adding, she was broken into recently, and she was making herself crazy trying to figure out who it was.
Webb remembers then that Raleigh Sharp had confessed to breaking into this house. He remembers the address, 32 Finch. The woman says,
she was making a bit of a nuisance of herself, to be honest, telling people they might have been broken into and not know it, getting everybody worried.
She shakes her head, clearly unnerved.
It's terrible what happened to her. Nothing ever used to happen around here.
Did you see anyone coming or going from her house in the last few days?
She looks at him in sudden dismay, as if something has just occurred to her. She says uneasily,
actually, now that you mention it, I did see someone.
Glenda looks up with a start when Detectives Webb and Moen re-enter the interview room. They have been gone a long time, leaving her to stew in her own fear and anxiety. Webb reads her her rights.
I don't need a lawyer, she says, frightened.
Are you sure? Webb asks.
I didn't know anything about that key.
Very well, Webb says equably. Then he says, Carmen Torres has been murdered. She feels all the blood drop from her head. She fears she might faint. She grabs the edge of the table. Webb leans in close. We think you killed her.
Glenda feels herself blanch, shakes her head. I didn't kill her.
You were seen, Webb says bluntly. Carmen Torres figured out what you'd done, that you'd killed Amanda Pierce.
He looks at her for a long moment, his eyes on hers. Finally, she looks away. She lets herself fall apart. There's no way out. Another mistake that she will pay dearly for. She shouldn't have killed Carmen, the prying bitch. She must have been out of her mind to do it, blinded by fear. She'd acted on instinct. She hadn't thought things through.
Finally, she lifts her head, looks at the detectives, and manages to say, Yes, I killed her. I was afraid she'd figured it out.
She averts her eyes, defeated, and says, I killed Amanda Pierce. She was having an affair with my husband.
Webb and Moen leave the interview room and consult quietly down the corridor.
What do you think? Webb asks.
What, you don't believe her? Moen says.
I believe she killed Carmen Torres. But I think she was lying when she said she killed Amanda Pierce. Her eyes shifted away at that point. Her body language changed. I think she's protecting someone.
Her husband?
I don't think she'd confess to murder to protect her husband, do you?
Chapter 39.
I'm shaking so hard anyone can see it. I feel nauseated, but it's not just from the drinking. The detectives take me into a room with a camera pointing at me from a corner in the ceiling. I know that my parents are both here somewhere in other rooms like this one. The woman detective brings me a can of soda. They introduce themselves as Detective Webb and Detective Moen. The other woman here is a lawyer. Detective Webb goes over procedure, but I can hardly take anything in. He turns on the tape. He says, Adam, your mother has confessed to killing Amanda Pierce. I look back at him, unable to speak, shaking my head. I fight the urge to throw up, swallow the bile back down. She told me never to admit what I'd done. But she never told me she would say that she had done it. I wish she was here beside me to tell me what to do now. I lick my dry lips.
She told us that she went to the cabin and beat her to death with a hammer and put the body in the lake.
I start to cry. After a while, I manage to say, shaking my head, No, I killed Amanda Pierce. It's such a relief to say it out loud. It's been like a monster inside my head, screaming to get out. I know my mother has been afraid that I'm going to get drunk and just blurt it out somewhere. I've been afraid of that, too. Well, she won't have to worry anymore.
The detectives look back at me, waiting.
I have to tell them everything.
My dad was sleeping with Amanda Pierce.
How did you know? Webb asks.
He keeps all his usernames and passwords written down in a notebook in the back of his desk. I got into his computer and found his private online email account. He'd hidden it. He always deletes his browser history so his email account doesn't show up. I saw their emails. I knew he was seeing someone, but I didn't know who because they used made-up names on their email addresses. She was pregnant. I thought he was going to leave my mom and start a new family with her. My mom didn't know anything about it.
I swallow and stop. I wonder how things might have turned out differently if I'd told my mother what I knew instead of going up to the cabin.
What happened, Adam? The woman detective, Moen, asks gently.
I blubber out my story. I knew he was meeting her that night out at the Sharps' cabin. I overheard him talking to her on his phone. I wanted to see who she was, that's all. I didn't plan to kill her. It's the truth, and I look at all three of them to see if they believe me, but I can't tell what they're thinking. I took my mom's car. I don't have my license yet, but I've been learning to drive in her car, and I'd been out to the cabin lots of times with my parents, so I knew the way. Dad told us he'd be home that night by around 9. I wanted to get there after my dad left and see her. Find out who she was and tell her to fuck off. Tell her that I was going to tell my mother about her.
I pause for a minute, gathering courage for the next part. What time was this, Adam? Webb asks.
It was around 8:45, I think. Maybe 9. I'm not sure exactly. I take a deep breath. I left the car in the road and walked up to the cabin and looked in the front window. I recognized her. I knew who she was. I'd seen her around the neighborhood. I thought about leaving then. I wish I had, but instead I opened the door. She was standing at the back of the kitchen, looking out the windows at the lake. She whirled around. I close my eyes for a moment, remembering. I'm shaking again. My eyes fly open. She was smiling, probably expecting my dad. But then she saw it was me. I don't think she even knew who I was. There was a hammer on the counter. I saw it and I picked it up without even thinking about it. I was so mad at her and my dad. It just came over me, this rage. I lunged at her and hit her in the head with the hammer. I stop talking and they all stare at me as if they can't look away. I can feel tears running down my face now, and I don't care. I'm sobbing as I talk. I just hit her and hit her, and I didn't even care that I was killing her.
How many times did you hit her? Detective Webb asks after a minute.
I don't remember. I wipe the snot from my face with my sleeve. I just kept hitting her until she was dead. I stop talking again. I have no energy left to tell them the rest. I want to go home and sleep. But I know I won't be able to go home. The silence seems to go on for a long time. Detective Moen asks, "What did you do then, Adam?" I look up at her in fear. I sat there on the floor for a while. Once the shock wore off, I couldn't believe what I'd done. I was covered in blood. I didn't know what to do. I swallow. So I called my mother. Detective Moen looks back at me sympathetically. I decide to look only at her. She seems kind, and I'm so scared, but I have to go on. I look only in her eyes, no one else's, as I tell the rest of my story. I told my mom what I'd done. I asked her to help me. I start to sob again. She drove up to the cabin in my dad's car. When she got there and saw me, I thought she'd hug me and tell me it was going to be all right and call 911. But she didn't. I'm crying so hard now I have to stop for a minute. After a while, I keep going. She didn't hug me, but she said, "I love you, Adam, no matter what. I'll help you, but you must do exactly as I say." She was wearing gloves, and she handed me some gloves, too. She gave me a big black garbage bag and told me to put it over my head and poke my head through so I wouldn't get any fibers on the body. And then she told me to pick Amanda up and put her in the trunk of her car. She brought me a change of clothes and a lot of plastic bags. Once I had Amanda in the car, she told me to go down to the lake and strip off all my clothes and put them in the bags and wash myself in the lake. The water was freezing. My voice has become monotonous now. I put on the clothes she brought me. She scrubbed the whole place down until it looked like it did before. While she was cleaning, I went out in the rowboat. It was really dark. I dropped the hammer in the middle of the lake and weighed down the bag of my clothes with heavy rocks and knotted it up tight and dropped it in a different part of the lake, just like she told me. Once everything was cleaned up, Mom got in Amanda's car and drove it, and I followed in her car. She stopped at a bend in the road. By then it was very late, past midnight. I left her car a little distance away, and then I joined her. She lowered all the windows, and the two of us pushed the car into the water. It sank right away. She told me no one would ever find it, that as long as I kept my nerve and never said anything, no one ever had to know. And then we drove back to the cabin to check everything and to get my dad's car. Then we drove home. I drove her car, and she followed me in my dad's car. When we got home, Dad had gone to bed. Mom had told him that she was going to her friend Diane's and that I was at a party. He didn't seem to question it, but I don't really know. I don't know if he noticed that both the cars were gone that night. I know he must have gone back to the cabin the next day like he planned. I stayed in my room all day, sick and terrified. He came home and acted as though nothing was wrong, but I could tell he was tense. We all acted as though nothing was wrong. But I'd killed her. And my mom knew, and I think my dad might have guessed. I look up at Moen and say, "My mom didn't kill her. She just helped clean up my mess. It was my fault. And hers. Amanda's. My parents were perfectly happy until she came along."
"Your mother is an accessory to murder," Detective Webb says.
"No," I protest. "She didn't have anything to do with it."
I slump in my chair, exhausted. I look at Detective Moen.
I'm too scared to look at Webb or the lawyer. What's going to happen to me? I ask. She frowns at me, but there's a grim sort of kindness in her frown and sadness in her eyes. I don't know. She glances at my lawyer. But you're only 16. It'll get sorted out.
Webb sits back in his chair and watches quietly as Moen consoles Adam, his attorney, beside him. Do you know Carmen Torres? He asks. Adam's face is puffy and blotchy. He looks surprised at the question. Webb is certain Adam has no idea that his mother has killed her. He sniffs.
Yeah, I know who she is.
How do you know her? Moen asks.
She came to the house, talking about the break-ins, and I've seen her around.
She's dead, Webb says bluntly. Adam looks startled.
I saw the police at her house.
She's been murdered. Adam glances at his attorney, obviously confused. Webb has to tell him. Your mother killed her. To protect you. Glenda raises her eyes as the door opens and Webb and Moen walk back into the interview room. She has been sitting here for hours. She now has a lawyer who has been summoned and is sitting beside her. Webb and Moen sit down across from her and she can tell from their demeanor that something has happened. She steels herself for what's coming. Webb takes his time telling her. Adam has confessed. She tries to remain calm in case he's trying to trick her, but he starts telling her all the details, things that only Adam could have revealed. She begins to cry, silently, tears running down her cheeks, staring at the table in front of her. She'd finally understood, when she arrived at the cabin that night, about Adam's drinking, that he'd started because he'd found out about his father and Amanda.
He's a juvenile, Webb says. Amanda's murder was impulsive, not premeditated. He could be out by the time he turns 18.
She looks at him then, feeling a tentative hope.
But you're going to be in jail for much longer.
Her body sags. She doesn't know now how she withstood it. How she'd borne it without cracking. How had she ever thought that Adam could handle it? Of course he confessed. She thinks of the terrible burden of hiding the truth from everyone, hiding what they'd done from her husband, her slow realization that he might have figured it out, her fear that Adam would get drunk and tell someone what they'd done, her dawning realization that she had made a terrible mistake. She looks up at him desperately. I just wanted to protect my son.
Webb says, it would have been better for everyone if you'd just called 911.
Epilogue. Olivia looks blankly out the window. The nightmare isn't over, it has simply changed shape. Paul has been completely cleared, Adam has confessed. Olivia can't wrap her head around it. All along, Adam was the one who had killed Amanda, and Glenda had helped him cover it up. And Olivia had had no idea. The thought of what happened at their cabin makes her shrink in revulsion. She will never go out there again. They will have to sell it. One more piece of her old life, gone. And Glenda has confessed to murdering Carmen. The shock of it. Olivia imagines Carmen dead on her floor. They say she was strangled with a cord. She tries not to think of Glenda throttling Carmen from behind. It gives her a feeling of vertigo. Apparently, Glenda had seen Carmen as a threat, afraid that Carmen had seen Adam and Glenda driving home in separate cars the night that Amanda was killed, afraid she'd figured it out and would tell the police. Perhaps Glenda had become completely unhinged by then, Olivia thinks. Glenda thought she was protecting her son. A mother will do almost anything to protect her son. Olivia wonders if this surreal feeling will ever go away. She wonders how she and Paul will go on. He knows that, for a time, she thought he might be guilty. That lies between them now. Her eyes well up. How will she cope without Glenda? She can't bear to think of Glenda as a murderer. She will always try to think of her as just Glenda, her best friend. She already misses her more than she can bear. She must manage somehow without her. Raleigh will plead guilty to 3 counts of breaking and entering and unauthorized use of a computer.
Because he's a juvenile, his lawyer thinks he can get him off lightly with community service. Raleigh has promised them that his hacking days are over. He's said that before. She's not sure she believes him.
Robert Pierce is delighted as his cold, dark heart allows. He hadn't known about Keith Newell. He'd thought, when Paul Sharp was arrested, that he had been the secret second lover. But it was Keith Newell his wife had been seeing, his son who had killed her. It's good to know, finally, what happened. It's good not to be under a cloud any longer. Robert recognizes that he's better off without Amanda. Things were becoming impossible between them. He'd considered killing her himself. Robert watches Becky go out in her car. Now he pulls on the gardening gloves, grabs the trowel, and goes to the back of the garden to dig up the buried cell phone. Everything has come to a satisfactory close, but still, he must get rid of Amanda's phone once and for all. He hasn't forgotten about that damn teenager who might have looked in it. There are things on that phone that he really doesn't want anyone else to see. Amanda was smarter than he'd thought. He's going to retrieve the phone and drive a couple of hours north along the river to a deserted place he knows. He's going to wipe it clean again and toss it into the deep water of the Hudson. Robert sinks to his knees and digs around in the earth where he buried the phone, but he doesn't immediately find it. He digs deeper, faster, in a widening area, turning over the dirt rapidly, his breath quickening with rage. It's not there. Becky. She must have seen him in the garden. She was always watching him. She must have dug up the phone. He rises to his feet, trying to control his fury, and stares across the fence at Becky's empty house, plotting his next move.
This is Kirsten Potter. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Someone We Know by Sherry LaPena. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2019 by 1742145 Ontario Limited. Production copyright 2019 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.